So as we wait this morning for the not-so-positively expected indicator called the unemployment number, which will be announced later this morning, look at the economic indicators. Or maybe I should say, listen to them. That's the sound of demonstrations in Athens, Greece, and right here in New York City. We might have chosen Israel, Italy, Turkey, Ireland, Britain, or any number of places where politics and economics are converging into a profound sense of dissatisfaction with how things seem to be turning out. Joblessness rising, credit shrinking, prosperity more the result of a ruthless grab for what's left on the table, an economy that pits people against each other rather than unifying them into a dream of prosperity for all. That's what it feels like, anyway. This is something the late Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Samuelson warned all of us about years ago.
Markets by themselves will get themselves inevitably into inequality and into their own destruction. It will happen again and again.
Economist Paul Samuelson, we wanted to take that idea and pose some pretty big questions to our next guest, economist Jeffrey Sachs, whose latest book is The Price of Civilization. And it grapples with this question of markets and social mission head on. Jeffrey Sachs, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Jeffrey Sachs, of course, is the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. The book, The Price of Civilization, Jeffrey, it seems to me, really begins with the question of what have we gotten ourselves into in 2011? How would you answer that succinctly?
We have a society that's divided into three, like Gaul, I suppose. One is a super rich at the very top, the top 1%, you could say. Then there's another 20% or so of our society, which are the affluent upper middle class. And then we have a lot of people hurting. And the forces of both politics and economics have been pushing the incomes, the job opportunities, the security of a large majority of the population down rather than up in recent years.
I'm wondering if this is a problem of scaling in the sense that we have reached a point in world history and the numbers of people on Earth and the numbers of people in the U.S. population, or even just thinking in terms of globalization, where the traditional economic assumptions don't work and we need a new plan, or have we merely lost our way from a traditional approach to economics?
Well, I love the fact that you had Paul Samuelson there for a moment, because Paul Samuelson had the idea that we need a mixed economy. That means not the free market, which is the textbook illusion that some on the right in the United States have been propounding. But Samuelson said you need a market economy for sure, but also you need government. Government is needed to ensure that everybody gets a decent education, that everybody can get skills that they need to gain a foothold in the economy, that those who fall down, whether through illness or bad luck or market forces, are helped back up. And it's really the elimination of the positive role of government, even the demonization of government during the last 25 years, that has done such enormous damage to the United States at a time when global economic forces really required us to get with it and to actually have government that was there as an active force for skills, for education, for technology, for modern infrastructure. And because of the politics in our country, which turned against government, government was nowhere to be found as a constructive force. Instead, we had tax cutting for the rich, and we had a cut of social services for everybody else.
Jeffrey Sachs, what do you make of the criticism that perhaps one of the most effective, at least in the 1980s, partnerships between government and industry could be found in the nation of Japan? But they certainly seem to have lost their way. The government-private sector partnership hasn't helped Japan in our time.
I think that the real model that we should be looking at are the places in Northern Europe, Germany, which has a very active labor market policy to ensure that kids get skills that they need and then a way to good jobs, or the Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, would show up on the top of every single list for good governance, for prosperity, for the absence of poverty, for low unemployment, low budget deficits. Those countries of Northern Europe have avoided just about every calamity that we're hitting right now. People think of Europe, they hear Greece and Italy and the southern European countries, which indeed are in the same kind of crisis we are. But in Northern Europe, where they tax themselves properly and they say everybody has to be included to make sure that they can be productive in the world economy, we're seeing very, very good results indeed.
You might also include Canada in that list. Just upstairs from us, our northern neighbor has a better creditworthiness than the United States does at this point. Would you say that the argument that's going on now as we get into the presidential campaign in the United States of whether there should be government in the economy is a 19th century argument that is completely discredited by events in the 20th and 21st centuries, and we need to be more focused on what is the moral sort of role of government in the U.S. economy?
I find it unbelievable that we're still hearing the same kind of voodoo economics that Ronald Reagan started, but the truth is that both the Democrats and the Republicans, because Clinton did the same thing and Obama in his way did the same thing for the first 3 years, that the most important thing was to keep tax rates down, to keep tax rates low for the rich. Only now is the president beginning to dare to speak out about this. What really happened in this country is that as globalization started to jostle things, push down a lot of the population and living standards, give added power, both economic and political, to the very top, the government became more and more almost a handmaiden of powerful lobbies in this country and a reflection of the richest households who are the campaign contributors. So both the Republicans and the Democrats for more than 30 years now have been on one line, which is we're going to cut government spending and we're going to end big government as we know it, was the slogan that Bill Clinton used. We're going to deregulate, which ended up in a financial debacle, and we're going to keep taxes low for companies and for the
right.
rich. And the result is this absolutely unprecedented inequality in America.
Well, we're living that result, and when we come back, we're going to find out what the price tag is for a measurable increase in the quality of life in the United States. Jeffrey Sachs, author of The Price of Civilization. Stay with us. Continuing now our conversation with Jeffrey Sachs, who's the director of the Earth Institute, professor of sustainable development and health policy at Columbia University, author of the new book, The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity. In the last segment, Jeffrey Sachs laid out our predicament in the United States and the global economy. In this segment, we're going to shift focus. Central to the idea of capitalism and American prosperity is this notion, and it's deep in all of our hearts, that if there is freedom to pursue happiness, if individual dreams of happiness are all aggregated together, then a nation rises, its prosperity grows, and what doesn't happen or isn't supposed to happen is a kind of ruthless chaos where the competition for individual happiness becomes more a collective misery with a few smilers there at the top. Jeffrey Sachs, how do we make structural changes in the United States that will bring dreams of happiness and prosperity to the widest number without creating some impossible-to-pay-for welfare state?
I think given this predicament that we're in and that we were talking about, we really have to go to that great slogan down on the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations now, which is, we are the 99%. And what they're saying is that the top 1% in our country has completely run away with the prize. They've come to almost have a quarter of all income, that 1%, when it used to be less than 10% of income that went to the top. So the inequality has soared, and they became so politically powerful that they got their taxes cut, they got their tax havens, the companies are parking their money abroad.
Let me just stop you just to elaborate. Do you believe that they stole that money by rigging the game, or that structural features of the economy meant that this inequality would end up benefiting a very, very few? Because that really bears fairly directly on how we're going to fix this.
Well, it's both, actually. Market forces were part of it. Outlandish and outrageous stock options where CEOs with friendly compensation committees just paid themselves gargantuan salaries completely out of line with anything seen in the rest of the world, and not a small bit of financial fraud and illegality also mixed into it. Every one of the major Wall Street companies has had to pay huge fines in recent years for dreadful behavior, really unethical, fraudulent behavior. And so it's a mix. It's been an abuse of the society, the way that politics amplified the market forces at the top. And the result is this gargantuan inequality. And then we wonder, well, where's all the income to do the things we need to do? We need to tax the top. And when I see that poor and middle-class people are sometimes opposing higher taxes, they're doing the bidding of, inadvertently, of the millionaires and the billionaires who have absolutely gamed the system. And when we talk about rebalancing, the higher taxation has to come at the top. It has to start with the richest people in our country, and then it has to go to the richest corporations, which, with the connivance of the IRS, have been allowed to park their international profits in the Cayman Islands and other tax havens. And so the corporate tax rate is now taking less than 1.5% of national income at a time when profits have soared.
All right, so that's the resource. That's the pool of money that might finance the changes. What do you think the price tag is for a measurable and significant improvement of the quality of life of the 99%, some of those folks who are down on Wall Street protesting?
We need to invest. We need to invest from early childhood development, because we have 20% plus of our kids growing up in poverty without even basic access to decent nutrition, much less the kind of preschool that gets a real decent start in life. And then we know we have huge problems in our primary and secondary schools. But then, shockingly, we have leveled off in the ability to see our kids through a college education, because tuition soared. And if you start in a poor or even a middle-class family these days, it's extremely difficult to find the way all the way through college.
So the educational system is exacerbating this inequality. But let me come back again to tangibly, what's the price tag for implementing these reforms? And we'll get to the issue of how are we going to reinvigorate the moral sense in government.
Well, I think that is a very practical matter. I would do the following. I would cut the military spending on these awful wars by at least 2 percentage points of GNP. I would suggest adding 1 percentage point of GNP to taxes of rich households, 1% of GNP of a wealth tax for that incredible accumulation of wealth that's taken place over the last 25 years. I would add 1 more percentage point of GNP in taxing the companies that are really getting away with unbelievable perks right now and loopholes.
All right, I'm doing the math here. We're up to about 10 trillion.
We're up to, well, just do it as a share of income, because that helps people to understand what these numbers are really about. So I've talked about 2% of cuts of spending on wasteful war, 1% on the rich in income, 1% on the rich in wealth, 1% on corporate income tax, and then another 1% on tightening up enforcement, a banking sector financial transactions tax, which Europe is trying to talk the United States into joining, and a carbon tax, which is going to help us finally move to a sustainable, safe, an environmentally sound energy system for the 21st century.
That requires a sort of moral sense of mission in government that I don't see right now. Are you confident that that can happen in the United States in 2011?
I think President Obama had it in his hands to do this. Unfortunately, I think he went for a short-term stimulus gimmick at the start, which was the wrong move. And I'm hoping that he will see the way forward to a campaign and a platform that is a long-term structural change. We don't need the stimulus gimmicks. We need the long-term change towards fairness, towards sustainability, and towards a return to productivity so we can have decent jobs in this country.
Jeffrey Sachs, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Really a pleasure. Thank you.
Jeffrey Sachs is director of the Earth Institute and professor of sustainable development and health policy at Columbia University. His new book is The Price of Civilization: Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.